All right. Thanks, Don. 312-981-7200 is our phone number. It is extension 720. I am Justin Kaufman with you till 10 o'clock tonight on the big 720 WGN. Jimmy Corain is in studio with me. Jimmy Corain, a great Chicago improviser and comedian who has a show at Second City that's running on Saturday nights at Judy's Beat Lounge. It's called World's Greatest Dad. Did I get that right, Jim?
Yeah, question. You really emphasized the question mark for the listeners.
Which is on stage Saturday nights at 7:30 through the month of November. Jimmy Corain, it's a show about becoming a dad at the age of 52 and lessons that you've learned about fatherhood. Jimmy, great to see you, buddy.
It's good to see you, Justin. We go back a long way.
Man, I was just talking before the break about it. It's been 25 years.
Yeah, you were working at the coffee. I was in the back of the bookstore, and you were working at the coffee shop.
How did you get that job? It was called
Tom Patz. Remember Tom Patz, right. Who worked there? You know, and I still am into personal growth and self-help books. So that's what drew me there.
Okay, so I answered an ad in a Reader. Okay. I could give two.
Right.
About personal growth and self-help. Right. I just needed a job while I was at Columbia College. Yeah.
You weren't even that much into coffee.
No, I didn't care. Yeah. But this bookstore was at North and Sheffield, and that right next to Best Buy, and
right.
it's and no
Whole
longer
Foods
there, and
there.
The Whole Foods
it was, like,
was
one
there,
of the first
right?
Whole
right.
Foods, yeah.
And it was a story. You walked in, and it was just like wow type music, and
the chimes you'd hear, chimes, smell some incense.
What was your title? What'd you do there? I still don't know what you did there.
I know. I did
heard coffee.
The introduction. You made it sound like I was a creep back there, but I sold. They had a magazine, and I sold the ads for the magazine.
Oh, okay. You know. But there was this. I have this memory, this great memory of. The sauntering Jim Corain. So you would come walking through, and you were just like kind of like in charge of the place, and you would almost like checking the books, making sure they were faced right, and you're right. You're doing the rounds. You're
yeah,
going around.
I was keeping an eye on because there was a theft problem, as you know, in the coffee shop of day old baked goods. And of course, you were, you know,
right, yeah.
People were called on the carpet several times.
Right. I have no comments.
Okay,
on the day old bagels that. Yeah.
I think it was muffins and it was pound cake, as I remember.
Well, you would crack me up then, and you crack me up now, and it's great to see you, buddy.
It's great to see you.
All right, so where's this? I talked about you being on stage and being honest with your work, because mm-hmm. that's really been your staple and your hallmark in all the years you've been on stage and doing media in Chicago. Why go back to it?
Because I wanted to see if I could still do it. You know, you mentioned in about... me doing I'm 27, I still live at home and sell office supplies. And that was the 90s in Chicago was just such a fun time here, especially being a part of the Annoyance Theater. And I'm like, oh, can I still do this at my age? And now I have actually a story to tell that I hadn't had for 18 years before my last show.
I was blown away to read that it's been 18 years since you've been on stage with a one-man show. I just assumed every 2 years you had a new Jimmy Corain show.
Well, thank you. You have to have a life to talk about on stage, and I didn't have a life until probably the last 5 or 6 years.
So what happened? What happened in the last 5 or 6 years?
Well, I met my wife, Lauren, and that made a huge difference. And then... and I talk about it in the show, I was trying to resolve this complicated relationship I had with my father. My father had he was a workaholic, but he was also a criminal. He was a white-collar criminal. He stole millions of dollars in real estate deals. And so I was married, having a child. You know, we were getting pregnant, or Lauren was getting pregnant. And at the same time, I was trying to, like... as my dad was dying, I was trying to, like, okay, let's make peace with your father before he goes, because you're going to be a father.
Hmm. Did you want to do that? Was that something that Lauren kind of pushed you into, your
no,
family?
Or no, like- it was therapy. I'm in group therapy, and they're like, you got to go. My therapist, Dr. Roth, is like, you got to go right now. He's like, you got to go immediately.
Your therapist is Donald Trump?
No, it's not. Does it sound like Donald Trump?
That's a very Donald Trump.
Oh, my God. That would be scary.
It was like every late night talk show is right. Donald Trump. You just did.
Right. No, but he was like, go immediately, make amends to your daddy's dying. And so I had hundreds of resentments, and I had avoided him. I not talked to him, even though he was dying and hooked up on oxygen. And so I got it down to 11 things, resentments I had towards my dad, and then 11 things he gave me as a father. And I went and
you just went there, and
I went there. I took someone from group therapy because it's not safe to be with my dad. And I read the 11 resentments and the 11 things I was grateful for that he gave me as a dad.
That's amazing. And what was obviously, you know, you said he was hooked up to oxygen, mm-hmm. and he was on his deathbed, but what was his response to it?
Well, it was interesting when I said, "Hey, Dad, I have this resentment list. I have this gratitude list." My dad was like, "I said, which one would you like me to read first?" And he goes, and I can't say this on the air, but he was like, "Read the resentment list because that other stuff is BS." And the thing that I love doing about this show, and at that moment when I said that, asked my dad that question, was I realized, Justin, that I'm so much like my dad. And that's been painful about doing this show, but it's also been helpful.
That's a big revelation for you, because your dad has been a character in other shows. You've talked about your relationship with your dad and how kind of ambivalent you were to him being a workaholic, but also about his criminal background. So there is something to be said about you coming to that realization that you are like your dad.
Yeah, and there's also a part in the show where I talk about fame and my obsession with fame. And my dad had the same obsession. He wanted to be a big deal in real estate, and he wanted a building much like the one we see now with his name on it. You know, it didn't say Trump, but he wanted, mm-hmm. you know, Corrine Towers. And that was like, for me, being on Saturday Night Live.
Wow, so you see that as a correlation, or you see that as similar.
Yeah.
Wow.
And that only comes from doing the show. And when I did the first run in June, I remember being backstage going, I'm doing this comedy show, why am I feeling so sad? You know? And it's like, well...
Classic. That's classic Jimmy,
yeah,
by the way.
Yeah, yeah. It's either sad or depressed. So I was like, because this is sad stuff to talk about. And then now in this new run, it just seems lighter and more fun to deal with.
Well, I was going to ask, because... You know, you say you're in group therapy, and a lot of it is
twice a week,
and you're trying to get to the issues that you know, make you who you are. Is it therapy to get on stage and talk about these things to strangers in an audience?
It is therapy, and I did a show that was pure therapy and not entertainment. The one, it was called Since I Last Talked, and it was about my dad being in the trial of my dad going to jail, going to prison. And that was that. I had not resolved anything, and that was therapy. There is a therapeutic element to get up in front of strangers and to admit not only that you're like your dad, but other character defects that you have.
I mean, how many times have you seen shows, people doing one-man shows, one-woman shows? You've seen other people who have done Second City shows. They're not being honest, man. They got a character they want to try, and they're trying it out, and they're doing different things. Maybe there's a kernel of truth in the comedy that they're putting forth. But what you do, man, you're putting your whole life on stage to talk about these things that I don't think that other comedians are mining. Then if they have these issues in their life, they're like, I think I'll talk about my dad. Like, they're just not doing it. What draws you to do this?
Well, what inspired me was I worked with a guy named Del Close, and he was this, like, improv guru who had worked with everybody, Bill Murray, Tina Fey. And so he believed that you get on stage and you just tell the truth and you can get a laugh. And I started to do that. I would just get on stage and just tell the truth, not embellished. And then I think it takes a little more of a craft, you know, now.
Sure, there's skill in
this. Skill,
craft,
and you've got to make a story about it. But there was something that drew me to that immediately. I don't know what it was, but I enjoyed that doing. I enjoyed getting up and telling a story about something true that happened in my life, then doing improv scenes
or
characters or stuff
like that.
Right.
But it's messed you up in a way.
Yes, it has.
Because I know you well, and I know your story. Yeah. But even when, you know, you had opportunities for success and fame and Saturday Night Live and other things, you got scared that your truth was not funny enough.
No, I think the Saturday Night Live thing was interesting because this was back, I was about 30, so it had to be late 90s maybe. And Saturday Night Live had, they were going to fly me out to audition for Saturday Night Live. And I think that year, like, Dave Koechner got hired, and Nancy Walls, and Adam McKay was hired as a writer. And I didn't have a support system, Justin, at all. And, you know, the thing is, no one in this business gets there alone. And I was kind of like a lone wolf. And I remember it was a weekend. I locked myself in the apartment, and it was like, it's back then you had to have three characters and three celebrity impersonations. And I had not done any characters,
right.
And I didn't have any celebrity impersonations. And that morning I went to my agent on Monday morning. I was supposed to fly out there at O'Hare, and I said, I don't do sketch. And it wasn't artistically, it was just plain fear, and that I didn't have a network of people to say, hey, Jimmy, you can do this, try it. Even if you fail at it, go out and do it anyway.
And that kind of plagued you for a while, right? Like, you're like,
it still does. Yeah.
You still think that, like, if you would have just gone with the flow, you'd be Adam Sandler right now?
No, I don't think that, but I think I probably, you know, like, I had a lot of friends that had went to write for Conan, and people say, oh, submit a writing packet. I didn't know what that was.
Right.
And I didn't take those opportunities, you know, that were presented right in front of me.
Jimmy Crane, my guest. This show is called World's Greatest Dad. We're going to talk about you being a brand new dad at the age of 52. Jimmy Crane is on stage with that show at Second City at Judy's Beat Lounge on Saturday nights at 7:30 through the month of November. All right, we'll take a quick break. Come back more with Jimmy here on Extension 720. Stay with us. Extension 720 here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. 312-981-7200 is a number. 10 o'clock is when we're off the air. Who's on? I don't know who's up at 10. Mark Carmen's in, so that's awesome. Always great. Carmen's on. He's fantastic.
I like how prepared you are. You look at this monitor.
Jimmy Crane is here.
Nothing's changed.
World's Great. I'm an improv guy, right?
Yeah.
World's Greatest Dad is the show that's on stage at Second City at Judy's Beat Lounge Saturday nights at 7:30. Jimmy Crane talking about his experience of being a dad at the age of 52. Did you want to be a dad?
I was going to say, what?
52?
I didn't want to be a dad. I did not want to be a dad. What happened was, and I talk about it in the show, my therapist, who sounds like Donald Trump, according to you, said I was miserable. I mean, I'd gotten married. We had bought a house. We had gotten a cat. And he goes, and I'm just like so unhappy because I'm not famous. And he says, well, if you want to bring more joy in your life, maybe you and your wife should have a baby. And so I'm like, wait, are you saying after 10 years in therapy that if we have a baby that I'll get famous? So I went home that night and I told Lauren, we got to get pregnant.
I'll be famous.
Yeah. Yes. And 3 years, my daughter Betsy's 3 years old, and I'm still not close.
What was it like for you? Because you'll hear so many people, and that's what I always like about how honest you are. We talk about the truth, but you know, obviously the joy of having a child, and everyone will say, "Oh my God, it's the best thing in the world."
No. That wasn't my experience. And what all these parents had promised me that I was going to, once Betsy came out, the first day, right in the delivery room, that I would be filled with joy. I was not filled with joy. I was filled with terror. And as you know, anyone who's ever been in seeing a newborn baby a couple months fresh out of their mother's womb know that they're not very attractive looking, things,
right.
You know, babies. And that freaked me out because I had this idea from the media that babies are supposed to be cute, and I was expecting this really cute baby. So I totally freaked out. And I talk about that in the show. And then I think, Justin, this thing of like, oh, you're going to love this baby immediately. It took me about probably 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, probably almost a year before I really started to love my daughter. And that's what I love doing about the show, is being honest about that process. Because
it's hard to be honest about that process, because there's probably people listening right now like, you will love that baby. You should have loved that baby. At the minute it was there in your arms. What's the matter with you, Jimmy? Like, there's so much judgment that goes into parenting.
Yes, yeah. And every time I brought that, would bring that up to other parents, they just think you were a downer. And like, and I was angry at parents, like, why didn't you warn me it was going to be hard? Because we had not gotten any sleep, and babies cry and they scream and stuff like that. And
you weren't warned about that?
If I wasn't listening.
You got my email. I would have told you about it.
Right. And I really wanted to put my daughter on Craigslist. You know? But
luckily, Craigslist went out of style.
Right. We did not get many offers, as I remember. Somebody wanted to swap her for like
Some hockey sticks,
but it was like all the way in Burr Ridge. And I'm like, we're not driving to Burr Ridge. We live in Evanston.
Why do you think that the joy wasn't there? Does it have to do with your relationship with your dad?
No, it has to do with my relationship with joy. And that's why I'm in therapy. It's like, I don't know how to have joy. And so I'm glad that I'm married to Lauren, who points out and says, you know what, you're having fun now? Because I don't even know when I'm having joy. I teach improv. So the other day I was teaching my daughter's preschool class. They're like 3 years old. They're 3-year-olds, and I was doing some improv games, and it brought me a lot of joy. And I remember going back to my therapist yesterday, and I was having a lot of fun. He's like, no, you weren't. You're like, what do you mean? He's like, because you have a bad relationship with joy, and I don't know when I'm having a good time.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
The thing about you, Jimmy, is I'm fascinated by that, because you are one of these guys. The minute that I see you, you got a smile on your face and you're looking for some sort of comedy. And I don't know what it is. Like, it might just be our relationship to 25 years, but the smiles are there and you always seem to be excited and anticipating something spontaneous to happen. And to me, that seems like the ingredients for joy. And to know that that is hard for you to attain is interesting.
Right. And it's really sad because I teach improv, which is all about play and joy. And I do it because the teacher's trying to learn from the students. But I think with our relationship, we go back, we're improv guys. And, you know, we've been in the trenches, not only at Transitions, but on another radio station. So there's that instant, like, I'm glad to see you. Because we shared a lot of good times and did a lot of good stories.
Yeah, right.
And did a lot of bits together. And, you know, I mean, so there's that kinship. Yeah. But I think I throw people off because I'm outgoing, but I'm really very depressive.
I love it. Jimmy Corain is my guest. Can you stick around? Can you stick around
I'd love to.
After the news? We'll continue to, because we have so much to catch up about.
Yes,
25
we do.
Years ago. I have some stories I want to corroborate. I just want to know. I feel like, you know, I had this conversation with Professor Genie about, like, embellishing the truth. We're talking about lying, mm-hmm. the nature of lying. And I feel like there are a couple stories, and we're working together, that have become, like, lore stories, where I'm like, remember when this happened and that happened? And I'm like, is that even real? Is that true anymore?
I'd love to talk about it.
Jimmy Corain is here. The show is called World's Greatest Dad.
You got the question mark. Good.
It's good. I'm good with language. Yeah. I'm good
punctuation?
Punctuation. Yeah, that's the word I was not looking for, right? At Judy's Beat Lounge at Second City on Saturday at 7:30 through the month of November. We'll take a break here, come back, get Don's news, and continue with Jimmy Corain. Stay with us. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. It's extension 720. I'm Justin Kaufman. Mark Carmen coming up next at 10 o'clock. Jim Corain is in studio. World's Greatest Dad is on stage at Judy's Beat Lounge at Second City, running on Saturdays through November. And I want to say 608, or I think it's 630, says, I can relate to your guest, Jimmy. I was a 17-year-old girl. When I gave birth, I felt like she was an alien. I didn't feel the love for her until she was about 6 months old.
Oh, that's really nice.
So there you go. So you're not alone.
Yeah, because I did feel alone, you know.
Did you?
Yeah.
Is that part of it, too? I mean, I would think that, you know, as we talk about your a lot of this show is about you at the age of 52 becoming a father,
right.
and that's what your one-man show and what you're talking about, your relationship with your dad. But, I mean, how much of it is about being alone and feeling alone and trying to get over that feeling of being, like you said, a lone wolf?
Yeah, I think, you know, especially this run that I have currently is like, as I went through it, and I'm working with a guy named Dave Maher, who did the Coma show, and he's directing it, I would start redoing different parts, I'm like, oh my God, this is just lonely. I'm just a lonely guy. And it's good to realize that, you know, that I am a lonely guy. And you know, now I'm trying to get out there more. I'm trying to overcompensate for finding out that I'm lonely.
When you're doing a one-man show, and you look at the script and you're working with a director, is there a point when you're like, oh my God, this is just, like you said, one of your shows was just therapy. Like, oh, none of this is funny. Like, at what point do you have to balance telling the stories of what you're feeling and telling jokes?
Well, I think that, first of all, you don't know until you get it on stage and do it multiple times if what's working or not. But I think, and then I have this like internal sense like, oh, it's getting a little too sad now. We need to add something, you know. So I think when I get it in front of an audience, that and it's the most painful part because you're not perfect in front of an audience. That's there's like something inside me that's like, okay, we need to lighten it up here. We need a joke. We definitely need a joke here, because storytelling for me is like it's, you want to tell the truth, but you also want people to laugh too.
Maybe.
For me, it does.
At some point, you're so close to being that guy who's just going to get rid of the jokes, and you're going to be like the hour long dramatic, you know, go on college tour where you just tell dramatic stories.
Oh my God, that is so sad. If that you see what my future
is, money, man, you're going to make so much money doing that.
What, taking all the comedy out?
Yeah, take all the comedy out and just do like group therapy with the audience. Make a ton of money, Joe. I'm just telling you, man.
It's a great idea. I'm writing it down right now.
Write it down.
In my notebook. My idea notebook.
For you, when you are a dad who's 52,
right?
Now
55.
55 years old, you know, when you're having 3-year-old play dates, that's got to be difficult. I would assume there's not a lot of 55-year-old dads.
There's like, in my daughter's preschool, there's like 40-ish dads, you know, but I'm less self-conscious, but when we first had Betsy, I'm 55, but I probably look 60-ish, and I can't add it. So I try to wear a lot of hoodies, you know, so I look hip. But I am very self-conscious, and so when I'm in public, because I've gotten, isn't that nice? Your grandfather's taking you out for ice cream. So when I'll come into a place sometimes, I'm like, I'm her dad. You know, like I'll announce it. It's a kind of a proactive.
You're proactive. If I get everybody's attention,
right.
I'm not her the grandpa.
Right. I'm not the grandfather, but I do want a senior discount, okay? But I'm not her grandfather.
Do you find that that there's an energy issue, you know, being 55 and having a 3-year-old? Are you just like, what is happening?
Yeah, she's killing me. She's killing me. I've noticed that bending, you're on the floor a lot more than I thought, you know? And so my knees, I'm
what
having
to... What do you mean, that he thought?
I was clueless.
You were painting the picture that you didn't even think at all about
clueless. I was totally clueless. And I'm going to tell you something.
By design.
I'm going to tell you this. By design, right.
You didn't want to do any work. You didn't read a book about what it was going to be like.
And when Lauren got up and she said her water broke, I was like, oh, her water broke. I'm going to go back to bed. Because we went through baby school, and they're like, well, you know, the average birth, it takes 24 hours. So I'm figuring 24 hours, I could get at least 8 hours in here, you know? I mean, I was totally clueless. I could never be a spokesman for fatherhood, you know?
You're doing a good job of it.
Thank you.
So now, I mean, because there's going to be different stages. I mean, how do you like the 2-year-old and 3-year-old stage?
Well, first of all, everyone says, oh, you know, 2-year-olds are, you know, terrible twos. And the threes is awful because they can say, oh, this is what I want. And they get kind of manipulative. They know how to push your buttons. You know, my daughter's a great fake crier, you know, and I'll call her on that.
You call. How's that go when you call
I'll
her?
I'll say, "Hey, is that a fake cry?" Yeah, that's a fake cry. Or I love in the morning. I'll say it to my daughter. How'd you sleep last night, Dad? Not good. Not good. You know.
It's great. I mean, this has got to be stuff for the next show. You should do a one-man show about being a dad at every stage.
I'm thinking that this is a trilogy. And if you come and see the show, and please come out Saturday. We only have 3 more performances left. Because it takes me I do it once a week. It takes me a week to get over it. I'm not as spry as I used to be. So I'm saying a trilogy. If you come and see the show, you're being like, oh. It ends when Betsy's born. So we want to see, you know, the next... phases.
Yeah,
and I think I've got 2 more in me.
I can't wait.
Mom's still alive, so she'll die. So I've got that, and then Betsy will get older.
I can't wait to go see you at Second City when you're 78 years old talking about my teenager. She wants to borrow money from me. That's going to be your thing, man. It's always good to see you, buddy.
It's good to see you.
Yeah, I know. I feel like, you know, it's I don't know, like... it's, sometimes I feel like this show, Extension 720, is like the only time I see friends. Like, you know, just because we're on every night and it's a part of the thing. Yeah, I never see you, and it's been 25 years since we met, and it's crazy.
Right. And you said, hey, let's get together. And you say, okay, well, let me see what's open, and we can book you on the show.
Exactly.
And then after this, we won't talk or anything like that. And it's, you know, it's kind of a good relationship because we don't, neither one of us really are into intimacy. Yeah, exactly. This is about as intimate as we can get. You ask the questions, I'll answer them, and then maybe a picture, maybe a selfie, and we're done.
A little, some guffaws.
Right.
Some guffaws in there. All right, so you are in an interesting situation because you teach improv, and you still have a connection to a lot of young people who are getting into the business or who want to learn more about it, and you're an advanced class kind of guy. Do you notice a change that people are more open, younger people are more open to telling their story, telling their truth, getting into some of the dirtier stuff about their lives, maybe talking about being in therapy, things like that, than the generation that you came up with? Because you were kind of like out on your own, being able to tell the stories of the complexities of your life as opposed to why you hate airplanes, you know, or whatever it was at the time. Do you notice a new generation changing the way they approach comedy?
Yeah, I think the new generation is a little more cautious. I think the PC culture is affected that, and certainly there's been a lot of stuff in improv that has affected it. So I think they're a lot more cautious than we were back in
cautious of, what do you mean by like what they
topics,
say on stage,
like, and what they're saying on stage and topics, and there's certain areas they just
stereotypes, things like that,
stereotypes and stuff like that, they just won't.
Is it hard? Is it hard to teach comedy in 2019?
I think it's I've had to adapt in the last couple of years because of what's going on. I think it, you know, it's like we don't know, especially in the, you know, where those boundaries are, and each group that you work with, you know, if you're working with actors, they're gonna go differently. They have different boundaries than if you're working with somebody who's never done improv before.
Right, right. Well, I was just thinking about that because I know that part of being young in improv is to push and push and take risks and push and see what you can get away with audiences. Are they still trying to do that?
I don't know. My guess is in some places they are, but I don't think in a whole. It, like I said, I feel it's become safer. I think in because I think there's kind of more in stake, because when we started out, you like today in people were here in this city like 10 years studying improv. Now these people are coming, they've had 4 years in college, maybe even have 4 years in high school.
Right.
So they're not staying in Chicago as long. And the other thing, there's more opportunities. People will with writing packets, so they'll get a writing job on Seth Meyers and stuff like that. That never existed when I started out. The only thing we wanted to do was get hired at Second City, and then if we were lucky, be hired on Saturday Night Live. That was the path.
What I always find interesting is just the one-person show. And this has kind of been, I believe, to be a plague on the comedy scene in Chicago. That at one point or another, Saturday Night Live would come to Chicago. They stopped asking the Jimmy Carains of the world to come audition in New York. They would send Lorne Michaels, would come with Seth Meyers or other people, and sit in the back of the improv club, right?
Right.
And over time, what happened was you started to see one-person shows. So it wasn't an improv ensemble anymore. It was one person doing all their characters by themselves and doing their scenes by themselves and essentially doing an audition instead of improv or an art form or in a group. And that seems to be the nature of what improv has become. This idea that now I'm going to build my portfolio on stage instead of having a group or having 8 people and learning how to work with each other, the tenets of what Chicago and Del Close was doing. Instead, what you're getting is they're building up their reel, if you will.
Well, I think it's interesting because one of the big changes that I've seen when we started out, or when I started out in the, really, I started taking classes in the 80s. If you said, Justin, I'm going to do stand-up or I'm going to do a one-man show, you were like almost excommunicated, because we were like an artist colony, and we were improvisers, we were ensemble players. It was all about the team. And then I think in the last, which in a lot of ways is good, I think, People are, they are doing stand-up. There was such an anti-stand-up thing when I was starting out in improv, I cannot tell you. But I think it's good. I think it's good that people are diversifying and doing more stand-up, more storytelling, more sketch.
Okay, so my final question to you, just as, you know, Andy Richter, Jeff Garlin, David Koechner, mm-hmm. Tina Fey, Rachel Dratch, Adam McKay, as you mentioned. All of those improvisers left town, and they were all a crew with you.
Yeah.
Right? And the names, you were doing improv together at The Annoyance, other places. Do you wish you were in L.A. right now? Do you wish you were in New York? Do you wish you followed the same path that they did, where they left Chicago and said, I'm going for it all?
No. Now, would I like to make more money in my life? Yes. Would I like to have more recognition? Yes. Would I? But no. And I think that's what the show is about. It's like becoming a father and having a 3-year-old daughter and living in this city. This is a great city. It's a great city to create. You know, you're not going to get discovered in this. And I live in Evanston. I got a great life. But it took me a long time to get to, it took me in my 50s to get to the place where, you know what, I have a lot of gratitude for my life, you know, because it's, you know, I see those people. It's not that, you know, if you get a writing job on Colbert, you're working, you know, 12, 14 hours a day. It's a grind. And I'm not, you know, I'm not a grind kind
of
person.
I'm not a grinder.
No, I'm like, I could work 12 hours a week, you know, not a day.
Not a day. Jimmy Curran, great to see you, buddy.
Oh, it's always great seeing you.
Always great, man. Always great.
And thanks for having me on.
Yes, and say hi to your family. And I can't wait to meet your daughter. World's Greatest Dad is the show that is at Second City, Judy's Beat Lounge. It is performances are 3 more performances in the month of November. Second City right there in Old Town. You can find it online, of course. Jimmy, great to see you. Thanks for being here, buddy.
Thank you.